fundamental question that is faced by sports is, do they want, will the industry ever allow somebody to tell the truth on the air? But I don't think that today that will ever happen again. I don't think the industry will allow it.
All right, baby, it's time to roll. Let's roll, baby. We rollin'!
Live from the hotbed of mixed martial arts in Las Vegas, your host, pro MMA expert Larry Pepe, takes you into the completely uncut world of MMA. Warning, not for the faint of heart. Pro MMA Radio is not responsible for any side effects, which may include extreme excitement, increased adrenaline levels, and a sudden desire to kick ass. Are you ready? Larry, let's do it.
Welcome to Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network, proudly heard in over 170 countries and brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. I'm your host, Larry Pepe. Fight Night 125 in the books. How did it go for Lyoto Machida? UFC 221 is up next, and stop me if you've heard this. Another interim belt up for grabs. Can't say it with a straight face. Luke Rockhold, Yoel Romero, because, you know, Robert Whittaker hasn't defended in 7 months. Okay. More media ranking madness. And remember that segment we did just last week about the clear conflict of interest, at least in my opinion, with the UFC Performance Institute working with fighters? Well, we will add a layer to that cake later in the show. But first, let's get to our announcements. Our first announcement is about a fight that is not happening. Michael Bisping not fighting at UFC London. He tweeted, I'm quoting, don't buy tickets to see me fight in London. I'm not fighting. Just spoke with UFC. There were rumors that perhaps he was going to rematch Rashad Evans, a fight that took place a long time ago at 205 pounds, where Rashad Evans beat him. But this did not come as a huge surprise, because within the last few weeks, he said the following, quote, I'm just debating whether or not I take the fight. For me, whether or not these people can see, I have a bad eye. I have a bad eye, and my wife doesn't want me to continue fighting. My manager doesn't want me to continue fighting. I see out of the eye, but not as well as I used to. And I'm still a young man, so it's kind of the reason I may hang the gloves up. My wife and manager and friends and people close to me say, Mike, what do you want to do that for? You've done it. You've had the belt. I've done it. I've done what I set out to achieve, end quote. My only question is, where were all those people when you accepted a fight and the UFC allowed you to fight, because they're so concerned with fighter health and safety, just 3 weeks after George St. Pierre probably concussed you, choked you unconscious, cut you open? Where, I mean, his eye didn't get hurt in the St. Pierre fight. His eye's been hurt for a long time. Do I think it's smart? Yes. I think any time a fighter is openly confessing that they have a hindrance, which we all know, that maybe is bothering them, maybe whatever. But let's not use the eye as an excuse. That eye was hurt several years ago. He won the middleweight belt with that eye. He fought George St. Pierre with that eye. And then, for some reason, nobody around him thought it was a bad idea, nor did the UFC, or at least he wasn't listening to whoever was around him, because he'd already lost the belt, so it wasn't a championship fight. It was a money grab. It was an ego thing. He wanted to get the loss off his record, make a bunch of money. Good for him, but bad for him, and a worse look for the UFC. The fact that he will probably close out his career with those two fights, I'm guessing, does not sit well with him. But it does sound like on some level he has come to peace with exiting that way. And I am a big believer that anytime any fighter says it's time, that means it's time. He hasn't officially said that, but I suspect from the quote that I just read you and him not fighting at UFC London that maybe we have seen the last of Michael Bisping, who, quite frankly, has had a brilliant career that just about every MMA fighter in history, absent 5 or 10, would probably trade places with. And if he's not fighting at UFC London, then you must be asking, well, who is the main event? Who's maybe Darren Till going to be fighting? Well, we still don't have a Darren Till booking for this card, which is horrendous matchmaking. But wait, we now find out that the main event will be Fabricio Werdum versus Alexander Volkov. All right, in other news, UFC 223 in Brooklyn looks to be getting, not official yet, Anthony Pettis versus Michael Chiesa. I love that fight for Michael Chiesa. I do not believe that Anthony Pettis is anything that resembles the Anthony Pettis who held the lightweight belt, who was at one time just hell for everybody, fantastic jiu-jitsu. I thought at the time, the best 155-pound striker in the game. Michael Chiesa is an absolute grinder, unbelievable, consistent grappling, good takedowns. I think he takes Pettis down, and on the ground, as dangerous as Pettis is, I think Chiesa's jiu-jitsu is too good for Pettis to catch him. And if he doesn't, I think Chiesa will basically have his way with him on the ground. So we will see as UFC 223 starts to get lined up. Of course, in the main event, we have Khabib versus Tony Ferguson for who knows what belt. Who knows? All right, Fox 27 was a ratings disaster. Now, remember that Dana White said that this was looking like the best quarter in the company's history. As asinine a comment as that may have been in the third week in January, it turns out that if that's what it was looking like, the Fox show may have kind of destroyed that look. How about the worst big Fox show ever? In 27 editions of Big Fox, this came in, you guessed it, 27th, did less than 1.6 million viewers with a 0.5 rating in the key 18 to 49 demographic. So maybe last week when I said that it just didn't feel like a big Fox card at all, apparently neither did anyone else. And by the way, this is during the football season, a week before the Super Bowl, that this card took place. So this card did worse than Fox cards, many Fox cards, more than half of them, that did not have the benefit of the NFL games and promos during those games and so on and so forth to push the ratings. It is a 21% drop from the same Fox show last year. You go back 1 year, 21%. Go back 2 years, it is a 35% drop. And what makes that all worse is that this is during the UFC's contract negotiating period with the current Fox deal expiring at the end of the year and them looking for their next broadcast deal. Not exactly what we would call, what's the word I'm looking for? Momentum. But that, my friends, is not the worst news for UFEC this week in terms of their new broadcast deal. It turns out that Fox has over $3 billion less dollars to think about spending on anything with the letters U, F, and C because they signed a 5-year, over $3 billion deal to broadcast NFL games. I believe it's going to be Thursday night games. So, not exactly going to help when that amount of money is going elsewhere for live programming. Now, Ronda Rousey, in a related story, and I'll tell you why it's related in a moment, has officially gone to the WWE. I could not care less. I don't care. Somebody sent me a clip of her opening salvo where she came out and didn't say anything and stood in front of three girls and then Stephanie McMahon. I thought it didn't do anything for me, but I'm not a big wrestling fan. But I, you know, look, I know the way it's all scripted, it's soap opera-ish and all that type of thing. It's supposed to evoke some kind of emotion. And I thought, wow, something she does worse than striking. I kid. But who knows? Like, she's new at it. Maybe she'll be fantastic at it. I don't have the faintest idea. Again, nor do I care. It's not a Ronda thing. It's a Ronda and wrestling thing. I don't really care much about either one. However, it is interesting that while the WWE is negotiating a TV deal and UFEC is negotiating a TV deal, that the WWE now gets to use Ronda Rousey's popularity as a selling point that UFEC no longer has. Now, for her part, she refuses to say that she's retired and that she would never come back, and she still has difficulty talking about her losses and apparently has not accepted them or dealt with them even after all this time. But it is what it is. She's an athlete. People process things different ways. I just go back to how comical it is when people talk about her level of mental toughness, which we learned was somewhere near zero when she suffered a loss. However, I just think it's interesting that she is now, in essence, a bargaining chip, a positive that the WWE can put forward at the same time that they are competing. And make no mistake about it, they are competing with the UFC for broadcast dollars on the market. And they're really the only two competing because they're the ones that are kind of currently available in the sports/sports entertainment landscape. All right, we'll go to a quick break. When we come back, we have more information about how the Daniel Cormier-Stipe Miocic fight got made, and we'll tell you about that next.
This is Cain Velasquez, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
So Daniel Cormier disclosed an interesting little conversation that he had with Stipe Miocic, who he called before accepting the fights. Quoting him, "I called Stipe. Obviously, you know, great guy. I got to spend some time with him. Fantastic champion, just a pillar of his community. I can't say enough good things about Stipe Miocic. With that being said, I told Stipe for $500,000, I'm not fighting Stipe Miocic. I threw out a bigger number and said, for that number, I'm fighting Stipe Miocic. He goes, I effing love you. That's what he said. I said, for the right numbers, we need to do this. His wife is in the background going, yes, DC. It's a deal where this one is not about will. It's not about rivalry. It's not about any of that stuff. This is a competition between two of the heaviest guys who are champions to see who walks this earth with that title. That's it." End quote. Now, the interesting thing about that to me, and look, you know, they're both good guys. There's clearly going to be zero heat between them on The Ultimate Fighter, which will make for yet another completely boring, unwatchable season of The Ultimate Fighter. Now, he also said, which I think is interesting, quote, "When it was proposed to me, I was like, I really don't want to fight at heavyweight. Then he said that he spoke to Cain Velasquez. Cain said it was a great idea. So he said, okay, let's do it. Then he said this, quote, "When I think of a fight against Stipe, it's tough and it's a difficult mountain for me to climb. But the reality is I've always talked about competition and legacy. And when you think about legacy, if I am able to pull this off, there is no denying what I've meant to this sport and what I will leave behind when I'm done. I'm a dream chaser. I'm trying to do something that's unheard of. I know there have been two division champs before. Randy Couture had the light heavyweight and heavyweight belt, but didn't do it at the same time. Conor McGregor is the biggest star in MMA, and he held two titles at one time, and I'm about to actually do that too. If I win this fight, I am the greatest fighter of all time. I will have done something that is unheard of, and that is something I have always chased. I chased it in my fights with Jones, regardless of the belt. I would always say that once I beat Jones, I'll be the greatest fighter of all time. I believe that once I do this, something that was so crazy that no one has attempted, I feel I am in the conversation of greatest fighter of all time." Now, I agree with the last part of it, that he's in the conversation if he beats Miocic. But I don't agree at all that you can claim greatest fighter of all time when John Jones dominated you twice. Even if we get rid of the second one because of the failed drug test, he dominated him in the first fight as well. Completely dominated him in every area. And that's not taking anything away from Daniel Cormier. I'm not doing that. But if you're going to claim greatest of all time, Demetrius Johnson is the greatest of all time right now, in my opinion. Especially if he beats TJ Dillashaw. And I still think that Johnson's camp made a huge mistake because the discussion is that Dillashaw will come down to 25. I think Johnson should have gone up to 35, but whatever. But when he goes on about no one's ever done it, no one's ever attempted it, and he brings up Randy Couture. Randy Couture has done it. He didn't do it at the same time because that's when UFEC was actually run by a sport and not a circus, not a clown show, where what gimmick can we use to try to sell pay-per-views because we have this enormous debt because we overpaid so dramatically for this company that we need to run any gimmick we can, even if we run it into the ground, which they're doing with this two-division crap. If Randy Couture was the light heavyweight champion in that environment, you don't think that today... If it was today, you don't think they would have let him fight Tim Sylvia for the heavyweight belt? Come on. Of course they would have. Of course they would have. So, look, I am not being anti-DC here. I have a lot of respect for him and the way he handled the whole Jones thing. I've said that on the show multiple times now, just to be clear. But, yes, he would become the first simultaneous light heavyweight, heavyweight two-division champion. But we all know that the biggest reason for that is the environment of today's UFEC. And we also know that John Jones is the better fighter. And I believe on a pound-for-pound historical basis, so is Demetrius Johnson. Then he goes on to say, I never said I was abandoning the weight class forever, talking about 205. If I had said I was done at 205, then what's the point? I would just vacate the title right now. I wouldn't hold up the belt and hold up the division if I had no intention of going back. That's not fair. I don't believe him for a second. I believe that even if he knew he was leaving 205, he would hold on to the belt. Because what did I just get done reading you? That he would be about legacy, that he'd be the first person to ever do this, to hold the two belts simultaneously. Well, if you vacate 205 and then go fight for the heavyweight belt, guess what you're not? You're not a simultaneous light heavyweight and heavyweight champion because you would have already given up the belt. I don't believe he's going back to 205. I believe if he beats Cormier, he's done. And if I were his friend, I would tell him, I'm sorry, if he beats Miocic, I think if I was his friend, I would tell him, there is no better way for you to go out than right here, right now, holding up both belts and walking out the door. It's the Michael Jordan moment winning game 7 of the finals with the Swiss shot. What a lot of people thought he should have walked away. Okay. And then he hinted that Kane could potentially drop to 205 if Daniel beats Stipe. But wait a second. That wouldn't make any sense, would it? Because if he dropped to 205, who's the 205-pound champion? Oh, yeah. Daniel Cormier. So how are you alleviating the problem? So I don't believe he has any intention of going back to 205. I think once the UFC clears, USADA, my mistake, because that's all USADA. UFC has nothing to do with it, even though Jeff Nowitzki's his publicist and attorney, and Dana White is saying that he thinks he's going to come back this year. But yeah, when the UFC decides that he did nothing wrong, I'm sorry, did I say UC again? I'm sorry. When UBADA decides that John Jones was completely innocent of any wrongdoing and that lightning struck twice in the same exact place with the same exact person, when they decide that and Jones is going to come back, then who knows what happens. I don't think Cormier wants any part of that fight. Maybe he does. But if I were him and he would have beat Miocic, the best thing he could do is just walk out of the arena. All right, he also said that after he talked to Miocic, he talked to Dana, and that Dana, really what convinced him was Dana's pitch on history, quoting, "The guy doesn't only sell you on financial incentives, he sells you on history. He has worked with me for a number of years now, so he knows the types of things that make me perk up. He said, history, Daniel, history, epic, something that no one has ever done. Sure, 170 and 185, 155 and 145, yes, but no one has legitimately tried as the light heavyweight champ to go fight the heavyweight champ. Okay, technically, because Couture was retired when he came back to fight Tim Sylvia. Okay. Then he went on and told Daniel, this is the battle for the baddest man on the planet. Okay, so we'll all just pretend that Randy Couture never existed. Khabib Nurmagomedov says that McGregor has to wait for a title shot when he beats Tony Ferguson. Quote, this is not Conor belt. This is not interim Tony Ferguson belt. This is undisputed belt. And after we fight April 7, April 8, they're going to make it official. Whoever wins becomes the real champ. Now Tony Ferguson is still interim champion. Conor McGregor, they call him champion, but he isn't champ. Whoever wins is going to become the real champ. When I beat Tony Ferguson, I'm going to make McGregor a little humble, and he has to stay on the line. He has to stay on the line because he only has one fight at 155. And he wants to fight for the title? No. No way. When I become UFC lightweight champ, I'm going to say, hey, who's the real contender? Who has 5, 6, 7 fight win streak? They have to fight for the title, not for you. We'll see what happens, but I don't think he'll ever fight with me. I think they understand what's going to happen, end quote. Number one, if the UFC wants that fight, obviously the fight will happen. And Khabib will make a ton of money to obliterate and destroy Conor McGregor if that fight does happen. However, I personally, I've said it before, I said it again, I don't believe that Conor wants to fight Khabib. And if I were in Conor's camp, I wouldn't want him to fight Khabib. I think if Khabib wins and Conor wants to come back, I could easily see a situation where he strips, so now he doesn't have to worry about title fights, and they can do the third Diaz fight, which is really a big money fight for them as well. And Khabib can go and wreck the rest of the division, and then Conor can decide if he wants to retire or take the beating. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, the MMA media rankings have reached an interesting level of comedy this week, and I want you all to laugh and share in the fun with me. So I'll tell you why next.
This is former heavyweight champion Randy the Natural Couture, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
Welcome back to Pro MMA Radio. I'm your host, Larry Pepe. You can follow me on Twitter at Larry Pepe, last four letters, P-E. P.E. And this segment brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. So the MMA media, the bobbleheads, are at it again. All right, now, I have to set the stage for you. Remember a guy named George St. Pierre, one of the greatest fighters in the history of mixed martial arts? Remember he came back, gee, I know it's going to be hard because it was ages ago, but about 3 months ago, you might remember that he came back at an event called UFEC 217 and beat the brakes off the aforementioned Michael Bisping and became the middleweight champion after a four-year hiatus. Remember that guy? All right. We talked about that there was no question that on the pound-for-pound list, he is ahead of Conor McGregor. And we embarrassed the MMA media, who had ranked him behind Conor McGregor, who had not fought, can't make this up, for a full year earlier than St. Pierre. I know it's going to be hard to remember him, not in a boxing match, but he fought the November before St. Pierre fought. And then mysteriously, the very next week, the media must have had a come-to-Jesus moment, or their brains clicked on for a second, and they moved St. Pierre up to number two behind Demetrius Johnson and move McGregor back to number three. Now, in the meantime, since then, Dana White has been crapping all over George St. Pierre every time his name comes out of his mouth. And of course, Conor McGregor is the bromance of his life. So we looked at the pound for pound ratings this week. And guess who's number two? You guessed it. the object of Dana White's affection, Conor McGregor, even though he hasn't fought in what is now, I believe, 15 months, and GSP fought 3 months ago, George is now number 6 pound for pound. So the list now, I mean, again, this is just for comedy. You can't take any of this seriously because that would suggest that these rankings mean anything. But just for comedy, just to give you an idea where the media sees things. Demetrius Johnson, number 1, no issue there. Conor McGregor, number 2, huge issue there. Daniel Cormier, number 3. Stipe Miocic, 4. Max Holloway, 5. And George St. Pierre pulls in the number 6 spot. Six. But wait, he's not ranked at all at middleweight or welterweight. So how can you be 6th pound for pound when you're not included in the rankings in any weight division? You can't, is the answer. Cyborg, by the way, is number 9, Ferguson 10, and Khabib 14. So a very interesting list, if by interesting you mean ridiculous, out of order, and hard to explain. Now, speaking of Max Holloway, it turns out that the impartial UFC Performance Institute people apparently are really anxious to work with Max. Quoting him, "After my last 4 fights, I've gotten emailed by the UFC about my weight, about their nutritionist at the Performance Institute. Look, UFC, stop sending me damn emails. I have the best nutritionist in the game. His name is Tyler Minton. We make the damn weight. Medically, if they change a couple of things around, I'm probably not going to be able to make 145. If it happens, it happens. Medically, if the UFC adds more rules, I'll most definitely have to step up. But right now, they didn't. I'm a 45er. If they start passing more medical stuff, I probably won't be able to make it. It's just UFC with all this USADA policing the weight cuts. You've got to be a certain weight when you're checking in and blah, blah, blah. All of that medical stuff. That's what I mean. If they start adding more medical stuff, I probably would move up. Every time I check my weight, they're in disbelief, but I'm like, I've never missed weight in my life. I don't know why they're giving me a hard time, but medically, if they're the rules, then I wouldn't be able to make it. I've never missed weight in my life, but if they pass more rules, I probably would have to go to 155. We'll see what happens. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. Here you have an athlete who has never missed weight in his entire MMA career. And I talked last week about the uncomfortability I have from a conflict of interest standpoint with the Performance Institute working with these athletes, training these athletes. Now, remember, with Dana, remember he said, oh, no, they're not going to train anybody. It's just a place that they can come and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not the case. Not the case. We watched the countdown show with Francis Ngannou, where the guy from the Performance Institute is training him. And now we have a UFC champion who already has a nutritionist who has been nothing but spot on and successful with him because he has never missed weight. And according to him, the last 4 times he's fought, the UFC is hassling him, trying to get him to work with people at their Performance Institute. Again, it is completely inappropriate. Completely. And by the way, when Max says that they have these rules and when you show up, you have to be a certain weight, that's not true. That's a guideline because we all know that Kevin Lee was nowhere near the weight. Nowhere near it. And they let him fight at UFC 216 and with a staph infection that Bob Bennett's crew of competence, good old customer service Bob at the Nevada State Athletic Commission, let him in with a staph infection sitting on his chest. So, again, just like Ubata, just like WME, should not be representing currently fighting UFC fighters, only retired fighters, because, again, conflict of interest, this Performance Institute, it all feels wrong because there is too much of an incestuous nature between the promoter and the company and certain athletes. It's one thing to favor certain athletes like the McGregors of the world, the Rouseys of the world, because they sell a lot of pay-per-views. We know in other sports there's different rules for Troy Aikman. When he was on the Cowboys, I believe Jimmy Johnson famously said, if Aikman falls asleep, you nudge him and wake him up. If the guy who's the 53rd guy on the roster falls asleep in a meeting, you cut him, right? So there's different rules for different level of athlete. I get it. But this is different. This is an individual sport. There should be a hard line between the promotion's involvement with individual fighters, their training, their weight cuts, their nutrition, etc., their representation of them outside the cage. It does not pass the smell test. And when Max Holloway, who's had no issue, it would be one thing if maybe an athlete like Khabib, right? I still don't think it's appropriate. But I would understand it on some level if an athlete who's struggling, an athlete who, you know, seemed to really have difficulty making weight, getting his nutrition together, someone at the UFC PI reaches out and says, hey, we know you've been struggling with these last couple of weight cuts. We have an interest. Again, see, there's the problem. We have an interest. That's the problem. But we have an interest in you fighting and being healthy, and obviously you're struggling, so we want to reach out and offer a hand or offer some guidance or offer some ideas. I'd still have a problem with it, but less of a problem with it. But when you're contacting an athlete who has had no trouble making weight, zero, and bugging him to work with the people at your facility when he already has somebody that he pays that he's happy with, again, inappropriate in my opinion. We'll go to a quick break. When we come back, couple of things. Francisco Rivera gets the stiffest sentence that Ubata has handed out. And Steve Cho, one of our Truth Army, asked me a really good question on Facebook, and I'm going to answer it here in our next segment. And it happens to have to do with weight cutting and weigh-ins.
Hey, this is John Jones, and I listen to Pro MMA Radio.
So one of our Truth Army members in very good standing, Steve Cho, wrote me the following. I got a question for you, LP. The weight cutting issues won't be solved with more weight classes because fighters will just keep doing what they do. Correct. Exactly. So why not designate fighters to weight classes via hydration tests like ONE Championship does? I mean, it seems like a better option rather than where we're headed now. My initial reaction when I wrote back to him was that my concern is I don't trust these promotions not to manipulate divisions, etc., based on what's best for them, not what's best for the fighter. I'm also of the belief that the promotion and by extension the commissions who are financially beholden to the promotions, like customer service Bob, should stay out of it. As I have said before, let them IV do weigh-ins in the late afternoon, either the day before or 48 hours after. Let the promotion provide the IV for 4 hours afterwards. You can drug test anybody who wants an IV to make sure that they're not using it to mask, which they're not. This is a unique situation, and the fact that they even see it that way shows no understanding of the sport and the protocols and what really goes on. And if they really want fighters not to cut weight, then make them weigh in an hour before the fight and have to do medicals. Let them do a specific gravity test for dehydration, and if they're dehydrated, you get pulled. So I did go back because I was curious. I have to be very honest. I have not looked at the ONE FC rules in quite a while. I actually looked in my notes. I keep a file, and I saw that I made a bunch of notes about their rules but never got to them here on the show. So a couple of things. So here's a couple of their provisions. And by the way, I think Steve is right. I think what 1FC does is preferable to what they're doing now, because I think they're actually doing it the worst way now, pulling the IV and doing a 24 to 30 hour, whatever it turns out to be, weigh-in, has actually indisputably proven to be a certifiable disaster. The numbers don't lie. There's three times as many people missing weight, getting pulled from fights, dropping out of fights within 24 hours of when they're scheduled, and it wasn't happening before. So not to that degree at all. Now it's commonplace. Before it was odd. So I did go back and look at 1FC's rules, right? So the first is that they have to submit, athletes have to submit their current walking weight and daily training weight regularly by inputting it at a dedicated web portal. Well, that's worthless. They can lie. So that means nothing. Two, athletes will be assigned to their weight classes on collated data and random weight checks. Athletes are not allowed to drop a weight class when less than 8 weeks out from an event. Okay, fine. But again, my concern is that promotions that are financially motivated can move people around and designate them in weight classes to suit them. And the reality is, I don't know much about 1FC, so I'm not casting aspersions on them. But I don't trust promotions, period. I don't trust commissions, period, because I've been doing this too long. And if you're a long-term listener of the show, I've given you dozens and dozens and dozens of examples where I do not believe that promotions, commissions, individuals have acted in the best interest of the fighters and the best interest of the health and safety of the fighters, fairness of events, etc. So why am I going to trust them to do this in a way that is truly right and what benefits the health and safety of the fighter? I have no reason to believe that, having done this a long time, so no, I don't trust them to do that. Then it goes on to say that during fight week, weights are checked daily. Urine-specific gravity is checked after day after arrival and 3 hours prior to the event. Athletes must be within their weight class, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Well, my problem is this is a test for dehydration. So even fighting in your weight class, you're probably going to cut a bit of weight and have to dehydrate a bit. And the timing of the test could produce a false fail. For example, if you did the test in a close time frame to when an athlete worked out, they might be dehydrated, and all hell will break loose with fans if fights start getting canceled regularly because of all these hoops that the fighters are jumping through. Then it goes on to talk about catch weight bouts being allowed, but they have to be within 5% of the lighter opponent's weight. Who cares? Then it says 1FC will conduct random weight checks on athletes at our discretion. When? Are we to believe that they're going to show up at someone's house and weigh them now? In another country? Like, how is that going to work? And again, you're vesting too much power in promotions' hands to make these decisions in a way that I think is often going to be really for their benefit, and I don't know that it'll be for the fighters' benefit. Then it goes on to say that the usage of IVs for the purpose of rehydration will not be allowed. And my note, because this all stemmed from a fighter dying after getting dehydrated, I put great idea when someone just died from dehydration. Again, I am completely against eliminating IVs. I think it's nonsensical. And if you think you're going to turn this whole culture around without doing a weigh-in and a specific gravity test an hour before a fight, that's the only way that you're going to have fighters fighting at whatever weight they walk around with, quote unquote. And until you're ready to do that, you leave the IVs, you do the weigh-ins the afternoon before or 48 hours before in the afternoon. You allow IVs, you have the promotion provide the IV for 4 hours after the weigh-in, and you're done. And that is my belief, and I think that 1FC is in the right direction, and if I had more trust for promotions and those in power, which I do not, that's my opinion, maybe I would feel better about it. My bigger feeling is that, again, it's kind of like the PI thing. It's kind of like the segment we just did. This is an individual sport, and I believe that the promotions should be as separate from the preparation, all preparation, weight cutting, weigh-ins, training, nutrition. The promotion should step away, book fights, pay fighters, promote fights, promote fighters, and leave the rest to the fighters and their teams. Francisco Rivera gets 4 years. Now, remember, he tested positive for clenbuterol, claimed tainted meat, said he was vacationing in Mexico and ate tainted meat, would have likely gotten 2 years. Then he decided to go to arbitration. And when he went to arbitration, apparently, Ubata's investigation revealed that several pieces of evidence he presented were falsified. Again, I'm going from the document that was provided online that had to do with this whole arbitration and hearing. Apparently, Rivera is alleged to have given Ubata documents that show a fuel purchase in Tijuana, affidavits from an aunt and uncle, and receipt for the meat. However, apparently, again, these are the allegations, the bank account statement was falsified to show the gasoline purchase. The aunt and uncle are actually not his relatives, and he doesn't even know them. And the store address for the Costco where the allegedly tainted meat was purchased was approximately 1,400 miles from Tijuana, and the receipt didn't show that any meat was purchased. So if all that is true, my takeaway thought from all this is that if you are going to commit any crimes, that probably following this blueprint of your evidence and what happens when you scrutinize your evidence, this would not be the approach to take. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, Fight Night Brazil in the books and UFC 221 Rockhold Romero up next.
Hey, it's Steve Austin. You're listening to Pro MMA Radio with Larry Pepe. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
All right, as we head down the home stretch, our final segment this week brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. So Fight Night Brazil is in the books, and I am not going to talk too much about the action in the cage because the actions of several officials and judges must be brought to light. Leona Machida defeats Eric Anders by split decision in the main event, 48-47 for him, 48-47 for Anders, and 49-46 Machida by the incompetent Tony Weeks again. Now, when I heard the scores read, and I heard 48-47 each way, I had the fight scored pretty clearly for me, 49-46 Anders. I'm sorry, 48-47 Anders. I gave Machida 1-5. 5 was a close round, but I gave it to Machida. I gave Anders 2-3-4, where he clearly did the most damage, landed the biggest blows. Machida did very little of note in those rounds. Anders got a couple of takedowns in those rounds. So for me, it was pretty clear, the middle three rounds for Anders. So when I heard 48-47 each way, especially given that it was in Brazil, because judges, especially incompetent judges like MMA is littered with, can be swayed by crowd reaction and things like that. So when I heard 48-47 each way, okay, a little surprising, but not that surprising. And then when I heard 49-46, I immediately said, that's it. Anders won, because no judge, no professional MMA judge could possibly find 4 rounds in this fight for Lyoto Machida. But you could find 4 rounds for Eric Anders, 2-5. And then it was announced that Tony Weeks gave the fight to Lyoto Machida, 49-46, which is the equivalent of raising your hand and saying, I have no clue what I am doing. But here's the crazy thing. Tony Weeks didn't have the worst night of the night when it comes to officials and judges. That distinction, I won't say honor because it is a disgrace, goes to referee Mario Yamasaki, who did everything he could to basically let Priscilla Coera come as close to death in the cage as possible, because apparently that's what it was going to take. Valentina Shevchenko, now keep in mind, let me take someone else to task before I get to Mario Yamasaki, who was criminal in this fight. using that hyperbolically. He's not getting arrested, but he should be, because his performance was that bad. But you know whose performance was bad first? The Brazilian Commission. Because I don't care that Priscila Coeira, who's a tough fighter, she took an epic beating and tried to hang in there. I don't care that she was 8-0 coming in, because she was 8-0 outside the UFC. And if you took 15 minutes to watch her fights, you knew skill-wise that she belonged in there with Valentina Shevchenko as much as Phil Brooks belongs in there with Tyron Woodley or John Jones. That was the gap between her and Shevchenko is the number one ranked contender at a weight division above the weight division that Coeira fights in. And anyone who knows anything knows Shevchenko is going to dominate 125. You have a debuting fighter who has never fought in the UFC, who has never had UFC experience, and they sanctioned this fight, which should have never been sanctioned. So shame on them. But they look like shining stars compared to Yamasaki, who let this girl get brutalized. I want to give you the total strikes. 230-3. Now, when you're a referee, we talked about this with McGregor Mayweather, that the referee would not give McGregor a long leash in the fight because he's not a boxer and had no business being in there with Mayweather. It was a money grab for all concerned. We've talked about that. You have to know who your fighters are. You have to know who you're dealing with. And when you know you have someone who is among the best handful of women in the entire world fighting someone who's never fought in the UFC, who has no business being in there, you got to have a short string. Not only did he not have a short string, he let this girl get unnecessarily brutalized, and Shevchenko showed mercy on her by putting her in a rear naked choke towards the end of the second round, because it was apparent that she would probably have to kill her for Yamasaki to step in. And even then, to add to his complete and sheer incompetence, as he stood there, he missed the first tap. She tapped and he completely missed it. And then she had to tap again for him to get her out of there. I don't know what Priscila Coeira ever did to Mario Yamasaki, but I know what should be done. He shouldn't be refereeing if this is any indication of what he will allow to happen to a fighter whose health and safety he is there to protect. An absolutely disgusting performance by him, by Cab MMA, and by Tony Weeks. But for him, because that's health and safety, Tony Weeks is just incompetent, and he robbed Eric Anders of the biggest win of his career, which is bad. But to let Priscila Coeira get brutalized by that, by an obviously ridiculously superior fighter who she had no business being in the cage with, and props to her for her toughness and for taking the fight and all that stuff. But you simply cannot let this happen. The other winners were Michelle Prezeris, who missed weight for, I believe, the third time in his last four fights. So at some point, do you do something, or you just let him keep paying 20% and racking up his sixth win in a row? Timothy Johnson gets a win over Marcelo Gom. Douglas DeAndrade beats Marlon Vera, 30-27 on all three. Thiago Santos looked fantastic. This guy is really an unheralded middleweight who, if the MMA rankings meant anything, he'd be ranked much, much higher. He obliterates Anthony Smith, dominates the fight, and finishes him by TKO a minute and three into the second round. Sergio Moraes gets a split decision over Tim Means. Alan Patrick defeats Demir Hadjevic, gets a dominant decision over him all three rounds. Pollyanna Viana looked great on the ground, defeats Maya Stevenson, chokes her out in the very first round. And Yuri Alcantara, defeats Joe Soto, TKOs him in just 56 seconds. So I want to bring up another point since we're going to wrap up in a minute. We won't get to too much else this evening. The idea that this is your Super Bowl card, I'm old enough to remember. I've been a fan long enough to remember, like, I don't know, a couple of years ago, when the Super Bowl weekend card was one of the real tadpole events. It was one of those, you know, there's a couple of pay-per-views, Fight Week in July in Vegas, the New Year's Eve card, the Super Bowl card. There's a handful of cards that always were the huge pay-per-views that you marked on the calendar and said these events are going to be the ones that they try to stack and make can't miss. And we've gone. They've gone, not we. UFEC has gone from that to a fight night card where if you were watching, I know I was anxious for it to be over. There were a couple of good fights on it, but the talent level for a Super Bowl weekend card is amongst the worst they have ever put on. And if you were watching the broadcast, yes, you probably noticed it too. Tons of empty red seats in Brazil. Not a great look. That brings us to the close. Another episode of Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network. For all the incredible men and women listening to us on AFN, our sincerest thanks and prayers go out to all of you for everything you do. I'm short on time. I like Rockhold to beat Romero. We will see you, listen to you, and you'll listen to me next week.
You've been listening to Pro MMA Radio, your all-access pass to go beyond the fight. Make sure to visit ProMMAradio.com and full on-demand replays and show updates available 24/7. Come on,